Well, if we're prepared to share each other's beds, then why aren't we prepared to share our clothes and our fashion?
That is a very good point, and it comes from my guest on this episode, Jane Shepherdson. Now, if you work in the fashion industry, Jane probably needs no introduction whatsoever. But for those of you who don't, she's the founder of the clothing rental company My Wardrobe HQ. Before that, she made her name as the brand director at Topshop. Under her influence, Jane helped transform the British retailer into one of the most innovative and influential brands on the high street, pioneering many of the retail trends that today we see as totally normal, but a decade or so ago were completely revolutionary. I'm Carla Bazzacchi, CEO of WGSN, the world's leading trend forecasting company, and you're listening to Lives of Tomorrow, the WGSN podcast about how we will live our lives in the future. So, back to you, Jane. And before we find out about the future of fashion retail, could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, I'm Jane Shepherdson. I'm chair of My Wardrobe HQ, which is a rental platform. I'm also director of the London Fashion Fund, which supports young startups in the sustainable, environmentally sustainable arena. And I also am a trustee for Smart Work. So I'm trying at the moment to use fashion as a force for good.
So I'd love to talk to you about your career. I kind of feel like I know your career pretty well, but AR viewers won't necessarily, and I'd love to hear it from your perspective. So you started working at Topshop at 21, is that right?
I did. I actually went there straight from college. So I kind of learnt it from the bottom up, which I don't think was a bad idea, to be very honest. I started off, literally, I think I was sort of sending stock out from the warehouse. So it was really not terribly glamorous. And then came up through the buying route, became the jersey buyer, and then sort of moved into management when I sort of felt that I always felt that Topshop could be better than it was, and it really wasn't quite good enough for our customers, and that we could excite them, give them better experiences, give them better clothes, give them better design. So I guess that's what happened, really. I was, they called my bluff and they kept saying, all right, then you do it yourself if you think you know what you're doing. So yes.
But that was so the case. Remember when I was at university, I went to the University of Warwick and I lived in Lymington Spa, and there was a little Topshop there. And Topshop was not cool at that point, although I do remember I had an amazing pair of pink cowboy boots, which I'd bought from Topshop. But it wasn't sort of the destination. And then I moved to London, and I was working as a fashion journalist. I was at Vogue House. And it was at that time the Topshop mecca at Oxford Circus. And it was, you know, all the Vogueites, all the fashion journalists were at Topshop. And it was this, it feels like, looking back, that it was this wholesale change in a very short period of time. And you were the architect of all of that.
Oh, well, I'd love to think I was, but there was a huge team of us. But I think it's really all about knowing your customer really well and wanting to do the right thing by her. And we sort of felt like we were our own customers, partly. So we just sort of thought, what would we really, really love in a business? What would we look for? We felt as well that the whole kind of designer fashion was inaccessible, certainly for our customers, but why shouldn't they get great design as well? You know, it didn't seem right. That's what we tried to do, was to try to sort of incorporate the best possible design, the best possible service, the most fun, the most varied experiences, if you like. And I remember we had things like Peekaboo, which was vintage fashion, in Oxford Circus in the basement years ago. And we had sort of small traders who we'd sort of found around the UK and brought them into Topshop as well, so that you really kind of got an experience of everything that was fashionable at the time, you know, not only sort of the Topshop behemoth itself, but also these sort of small names, individual designers. You could kind of get everything there. We put hairstyling in there, we put a cafe in there, you know, you could eat there, you could spend the whole day there, really. And I think as well, it was sort of in some ways ageless, and that, you know, women could go in with their 16-year-old daughters and they would both probably find something that worked or was fun or whatever. So, yeah, I think it was just a team of people who wanted it to be something special, and that's what we tried to do.
Okay. There were two words that came out when you were talking then. One was experience, which I think is so pertinent, because that is one of the things that has changed so much in fashion, back and forth, if we kind of bring the pandemic into that as well. So let's come back to that in a second. But the other one was accessible. it was the fact that you could, as someone who didn't have a huge amount of money, but you could book a personal shopping experience. And that was something that you thought of as only rich people could do, but you could go in and be treated like you had loads of money and come out with lots of clothes, but it was super accessible.
That was one of our favourite things, I suppose, that we did want to democratise fashion. It sounds like a terrible cliche nowadays, but we wanted people to have that really special experience, you know, even though they weren't spending a lot of money. You know, what difference does it make? Just because you're rich, you shouldn't be able to get these great experiences. And it's so weird, actually, because we also had a delivery option. This was about, I don't know, about almost 20 years ago, I guess, or perhaps more than that, where it was Topshop to go and you could order and it would either bring a whole rail of clothes to your house so that you could have sort of a Topshop party, or it would arrive, your parcel would arrive on a scooter, you know, driven by this guy who'd just picked it up 10 minutes beforehand. And I guess it was the very beginning of e-commerce, of sort of, you know, deliveries. But it was a fun thing to do at the time.
What are the biggest changes that you have seen? And we've already talked about some of them, but in your careers, in your journey from Topshop to where you are today?
I think that, as you mentioned, you sort of touched on earlier, that the whole experience of shopping has changed so completely. And I think pre-pandemic, we had certainly embraced e-commerce, but not as much as we now embrace it. And sadly, it has meant that a lot of stores have lost their physical presence. Yeah, you can still, of course, go out shopping, and there are still great department stores such as Selfridges or John Lewis or whatever out there. But I think we've lost an enormous number of fashion outlets, which... So if you wanted to spend a day just sort of going around, and I, for one, find it important to sort of feel fabric and see what something feels like and before I buy it. And I actually quite like trying things on. I'm old fashioned that way. I like to have a look, see what's around, try it on, see what it looks like, see what the fabric feels like before I buy something. And I think that is harder to do now. I mean, I totally get the convenience of online shopping, but you know, it is wasteful. It's a lot of people I talk to say that they always buy two sizes and then they return one of them. Well, you know, someone's paying for that. If it's not us as the customer, then it's the planet. You know, there is a cost to everything that we're doing. So I think that's kind of sad. And I used to really enjoy going into shops that were visually interesting and exciting. And I still do. And there are still a lot of these sort of stores around. I think the whole kind of experience of shopping is fun, and it's the aesthetic of it is interesting. And it's one of the creative arts. You know, you might think it isn't. It's just something that we put on our bodies, but it is creative, and it's, and I love to see it done really well.
Yeah, it's still a treat. And maybe it's because of the industry I work in, but, you know, seeing store windows, you know, the Christmas store windows, I love going into Liberty and places like that. I find that so inspiring. And it makes an experience. There's something there to see. There's something to make you think about the world in a different place. And yes, you might come out with a new jumper or something at the end of it.
Yeah, but it gives you ideas. Anything creative gives you ideas. And I think that's amazing.
Now, inevitably, this conversation is going to come to sustainability. It's something that you've spoken about a lot, and you've really, I guess, put your money where your mouth is, because you're now championing sustainability through the rental platform. It gets talked about a lot, and something that gets talked about a lot, my fear is sometimes there's not necessarily as much doing. Do you think the fashion industry is doing enough, or do you think there's too much lip service in this way?
I think there's a very long way to go, first of all, both in terms of consumer behavior and also in terms of what the big brands are actually doing themselves. And I think they're not doing nearly enough. And I was delighted to see the legislation in France recently.
So for anyone listening who isn't aware of this, the French government are proposing putting a tax essentially on fast fashion, and it will be per item. And although they haven't singled out any brands, it will be those which are ultra fast, so ultra cheap. And there's the environmental impact, but it's also, I think, for protecting local brands in this instance as well. And you could definitely see where one government goes, others will follow suit.
Which will help, I think, businesses to try a little bit harder to do the right thing in terms of the waste that they're currently creating. But I do also think we have to take some responsibility ourselves. And I'm always delighted when I hear you saying earlier that you buy not that many clothes and you wear them for a long time. And I think that's so important. What saddens me an awful lot is the lack of value that we give to clothing nowadays. You know, if you can buy a bikini for a pound, pound. I mean, there's no value in that item at all. There's no value in the woman and it probably was a woman who made it. There's no value in the fabric. There's no value in any of it. And I think we kind of need to get back to realizing that clothes have a value and we should appreciate that value. I'm on this sort of, I think we call it rule of five, where I'm only allowed to buy five things each year. And it really does, more than anything else, it doesn't stop your joy of enjoying fashion. And I still really, really love it. In fact, I think in a way it perhaps increases that because you're doing it so many fewer times. But it really makes you consider how much you need something, how much joy it's going to give you, and what place it will be in your wardrobe, how many times you'll wear it. And I think those are really the kind of decisions that I'd just like us all to be thinking about when we buy something.
We're talking a lot at WGSN about forecast a lot around consumer sentiments. And there's this real kind of tension at the moment between what consumers say they want or what consumers say they will do and then how they behave. And I think nowhere is that more true than in fashion, where you have, well, you have all generations, but especially a younger generation who talk with such passion about sustainability and the importance of protecting our planet. And yet that is also the generation that is buying this ultra, ultra fast fashion. And those two things don't go together, unfortunately.
I think this generation are probably the most and the least interested in sustainability. What keeps me optimistic is that so many of them, and probably so many more of them now than of my generation, are actually buying vintage or pre-loved or whatever, or they're renting or whatever. So I think that's amazing. I think the issue with this sort of super fast, super cheap fashion is, you know, as long as we're actually offered it, I think people will continue to buy it. And I'm not for one minute talking about people who actually can't afford fashion. And I find it quite shocking that, in fact, there's something like 11% of people in this country suffer from clothing poverty, which seems to me to be ludicrous when there's so much waste connected with the fashion industry. So there is a real dilemma here. And this generation, it's not fair for us to say to them, it's up to you to try and change it. I think it's up to us to help them to change it. And all that we can do in terms of either changing behavior and offering other solutions. I mean, this is what it's about, is offering them different ways of doing things that are still fun and still enjoyable, which is kind of what brought me into rental in the first place. And I totally know and understand that rental is not the answer. You know, it's one of the planks in the bridge that will take us where we need to be. But at least it's something that stops you thinking you have to always buy something, that you can still have absolutely beautiful clothes and then you can just give them back afterwards. And to me, that seems like a great thing to do.
So why was it rental that you went into? Because there are other ways of being sustainable. You've just called it one of the planks in the bridge. But why was it this particular plank that attracted you?
I originally started off thinking that I would try to establish a sustainable clothing hub, something like the Immaculate Vegan or whatever. But at the time when I was looking for brands that I felt I wanted to endorse, I couldn't actually find any. I couldn't find any that had the sustainability credentials that I was looking for, but also had the design that I was looking for. And actually, I still find it very, very hard when people say to me, where should I buy my clothes from? In that Mother of Pearl seems to me to be the only brand that is truly sustainable, or she's trying her hardest to make it as sustainable as she possibly can. So I kind of was put off doing that. And I just thought, this is insane. If I can't find the right people, perhaps I would do now. I don't know. I know things have changed an awful lot. I'd also just come back from a year traveling around America, staying in Airbnbs. And I thought, well, if we're prepared to share each other's beds, then why aren't we prepared to share our clothes and our fashion?
That's so funny. You mentioned Amy Pounley and Mother of Pearl. I actually had her on the podcast about a year ago. She's amazing. And it was really fascinating hearing everything she'd had to go through to attempt to create a genuinely sustainable brand. In fact, anyone else wants to listen to that podcast? It's called Fashion Reimagined, and it'll be in the list of all our back episodes. So just search Lives of Tomorrow and you should find that episode. Jane, okay, back to you. Let's talk a little bit more about My Wardrobe HQ. So this is your newest project. I'd love to know who's leaning into this concept. Have you got an ideal or a target consumer who's renting fashion from My Wardrobe HQ today?
From My Wardrobe HQ, it's not the youngest. I think. And I think that that's partly because our focus is on luxury as on designer. So I'm not sure whether we're actually even as attractive to the much younger generation. So our customer tends to be, I would say, 30 to 50. Women who are relatively established, and I think probably women who are quite style confident. However, having said that, there are other rental platforms around who cater for different generations, different age groups. And I know that there was, I don't know if they're still going, but there was Higher Street, which was much more based on high street rental. And Her and By Rotation are sort of in that middle ground, if you like, much more the sort of, I would say, Rixo, Ganni, that sort of level of the market. And although we do obviously have Rixo and Ganni, we tend to focus more on sort of luxury designer goods. I have to say, more of our revenue comes from resale than from rental.
Yeah. I mean, that's quite interesting in and of itself, isn't it? Did you think that would be the case? Or has that, again, been a kind of consumer shift and you're monitoring that and then just trying to make sure that you have both options there?
I think it's actually always been the case. But what we are seeing much more of now is are people renting and then buying.
Okay.
So they'll rent it and then they will think, hang on a minute, I really love this piece. I could wear it in lots of different ways. I'm going to buy it, which is kind of fine because they're either dead stock from brands or people's own wardrobes that they want to sell or they're happy to sell. So that's fine. You know, they're not buying new things. I have a slight worry with resale generally. I think that we haven't dealt with the addiction. And I see people, the way that people talk about Vinted at the moment sounds very much like the way they talk about fast fashion. Is that I bought something recently. I'm just going to sell it on Vinted. And it feels like that there's still this awful speed of an addiction to sort of having something new all the time that I'm not quite sure that we've actually taken on board the fact that we should slow down our consuming.
Which is a really big topic. Right. I want to get to know you a little bit more. So we've got some totally not really fashion related questions. Quick fire, first thing that comes into your head. When are you happy?
When I'm outside in the country.
What do you rarely share about yourself?
I suppose I share what I feel is necessary, but I don't like to be dishonest. I think I would share anything as long as I felt I was sharing it for the right reason, I suppose.
However big or small, what one day-to-day life hack couldn't you live without? So it might be an app or something you eat or drink or meditation.
I hate to say it, but 20 minutes of Joe Wicks in the morning. That's really sad, I know. I started doing it in the pandemic, but it just makes me feel so much better and sets me up for the day. And yeah.
I like that. There you are. You've shared something about yourself for all the right reasons. Last TV show you binged, watched and had to recommend?
Criminal Justice or something with Kush Jumbo.
I love her. She's amazing.
She's so good. She's so good. It might have been actually called Criminal Record. I can't remember. It was on ITV. It was very good.
I love her. And when and how do you prioritise yourself?
I think I probably prioritise myself most of the time. So that's probably not a very good question for me. I'm not one that feels a real need for wellness. You know, I think I treat myself pretty well most of the time. So
we should.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It's a good answer. Okay. We're going to go into looking to the future.
Yes.
This is a pretty big question for you. But what's your prediction for the future of fashion?
Well, I think it's fascinating because I think we're at a real crossroads at the moment with the big hubs that we've seen for the last 10 years, like Net-a-Porter, Matches and Farfetch, all seem to be on the way out. If not already, they seem to be on their way. So that seems to be changing, I guess, because of people are buying directly from social media.
So how do you think people will shop then in years to come? Because obviously everybody has got used to shopping online. Is that, well, actually, I'm not going to ask you that question. I think that is here to stay. So I'm not going to give, you don't get a choice on that one.
Yes,
but,
yes.
But where's then the opportunity from a retail perspective? How will that evolve?
It is all about giving people an opportunity to engage, to have an experience, to feel something a little bit different. I think we're all going to use e-com for essentials and for stuff that there's a pain in the ass to get hold of. And, you know, that's a no-brainer. But I think people will be looking out for sort of experiences and engagements and times that they can sort of meet like-minded people. They can be visually inspired. I don't think that the small retailer is going to go away. I think you just have to do it really, really well. I think doing it badly, just pile it high, sell it to you, it just doesn't cut it anymore. I mean, why would somebody shop somewhere like that? You know, you're only going to shop somewhere that looks attractive. You might meet people that you quite like. And in fact, I was reading someone's post this morning who said that, I mean, she's a writer. She said, if I didn't say hello to all the people in the local shops that I go to, some days I wouldn't speak to anyone, you know. And so I think it is kind of an opportunity for us to talk to people, to sort of share ideas. And I hope that will continue to be something that grows and under its own steam.
Yeah. I did see a beautiful piece about the sort of evolvement in changing rooms recently. And that's sort of the new cutting edge of visual merchandising, is how beautiful can you make your changing room?
Oh, how lovely.
And I thought that was amazing. I mean, I've just said how much I love Topshop, but the changing rooms were never particularly pleasant experience.
They were terrible. They were terrible. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the idea that would be a nice experience, because I'm going to say, as a woman, it might be the same for men as well, but often that isn't so much fun. Then you take everything off and then you get rashes, and it's just, so the idea of going somewhere and that is part of the experience, that it's so beautiful, that made me smile. I was enlivened by that.
I think that's absolutely wonderful. It really is. I feel real joy hearing you say that. It just sounds like such a wonderful idea. Because not only that, but also fitting changing rooms where the lighting is like right above your head and everything that sticks out is cast in shadow, either brightly lit or cast in shadow, and you just look absolutely awful. So yeah, I think that would be a great thing.
Yeah, we're talking a lot about glimmers. In fact, a podcast that's already out, I spoke with the clinician who'd coined this term, and it's all about those just little moments of joy and how important they are in a world sort of facing polycrisis. And the idea that a changing room experience could give me a little bit of joy. I want changing rooms with glimmers in them. That's my ask to the retail industry at the moment.
Do you know what? I'm going to pass that on to everybody that I still know in the retail industry. Yeah. I think that's a wonderful idea.
But actually, talking about feelings, some of the research that we've done, there's a lot about how, I was going to say younger generations, but actually millennials, who aren't really the younger generation anymore, but millennials and Gen Z, they're quite emotional spenders. So they shop to cope with fluctuating feelings. There's a lot of fluctuating feelings going on at the moment. How do you think that impacts fashion and retail?
It's always been the case, hasn't it? I count myself in with this as well, that, you know, low self-esteem leads you to thinking, oh, well, if I buy that, I'm going to look amazing and I'm going to be a different person. And we've all felt that. And I think women have always shopped very, very emotionally for clothes in a way that perhaps men don't, or perhaps they are doing more so now. And that's what I've always loved about it. And you know, that the sort of transformational feeling when you put new clothes on. And I dress for Smartworks every Monday, where I sort of dress women for interviews. And just seeing them coming out of the fitting room, feeling so confident, but actually feeling like they're a different person and they're the kind of person that might actually get a job, you know. And I think it's very hard to pull those two apart, that the sort of the emotional connection that women have with clothes and the way they shop. And I totally understand that. I just think that perhaps we owe ourselves a bit more to make sure that piece that we buy, we give it the more value. We think about it a bit more. We consider it a bit more. Because I think, like anything else, you know, if you buy something quickly and without much thought, it's going to give you a high for a second, and then you know you're going to move on to the next thing. And actually, if you were to research it and think about it and feel that you really were worth this thing that you were going to buy for yourself, I think you would feel a lot better on buying it. But it's a very difficult one, that they're so closely linked.
But there's something in this, if we think about everything we've been speaking about, that
if there is that emotional response to pieces, the idea of then keeping that and utilizing that garment to give you that same feeling again. So we went through a process the last year and a half of selling the business. The PLC who owned us put us up for sale, and we're now owned by a private equity house. So I was pitching in front of big rooms of, you know, very important people. And so that was a very considered process about what I was wearing. And I don't know if it's luck or chance, the pitch to the company that eventually bought us, I was wearing the dress that I wore on my very first day at WGSN, which had been 9 years ago. And I know it was the same dress because I've got a photograph that I posted on Instagram on that first day with me kind of, you know, little finger up to the WGSN sign in the office. And it was exactly the same dress. And I knew that dress gave me confidence, which is why I'd worn it the first day in a new job. And it was why I wore it when I was pitching. And it just happened to be that it was the first one. So I'm never going to get rid of that dress. And I've already, it's done 10 years and it will probably do more. And there's something about that in terms of that's a really positive feeling. And it means I'm keeping something and I will rewear it. Maybe that's what we need to get across to stop people buying so much.
I think that's a lovely thing to hear. I am exactly the same as you. I have a jacket that whenever I wear it, I just feel the very best form of me. And I feel like I can do things that I couldn't do when I wasn't wearing it. And it does, it not only brings me joy, but it also kind of does give me an authority or something that other clothes don't. And I would never get rid of it. It has such value for me. I know that the lining is just sort of slightly going, and I know that I need to get it relined, and it doesn't matter how much it costs. We certainly need to get back to that feeling of really valuing each piece.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe this is the campaign that we need to launch.
Maybe. Yes.
Thinking about accessibility and people's different backgrounds. So not necessarily how much money people have, but where they come from. What about for you? So for My Wardrobe HQ and for Jane Shepherdson, what does the future hold?
Do you know what? I'm just going to keep on banging on about being sustainable, trying to be more considerate, trying to do the right thing. I love fashion. I'm going to stay in this field, but I think there's so much work to do. And I'm there to support any young brand that wants to talk to me. I will talk to them if they're trying to do the right thing. There's an awful lot that needs to be done. And if I've got the time to do it, then I'm going to do it. So I really am very, very keen to hear from anyone who's in the business and sort of can't find their way, as long as they take on board the sort of the whole environmental responsibility, social justice part of it. But yeah, I'll continue to do this until I die, probably.
So final question then, are you more hopeful or anxious about the future of fashion?
I was feeling very anxious recently, but I think the French legislation has made me think, you know what, maybe things are starting to change, and perhaps we will see with the next government, perhaps we'll see the same happening here. I think it does require legislation. I don't think it is actually something that we're just going to wake up one day and say, oh, you know what, fast fashion, nah, I'm not going to bother with that.
And we haven't really talked about the legislation angle within all of this, but if you have got a consumer that may not behave that way, but certainly says they want to, you have governments doing the right thing and you have brands and retailers doing the right thing, then you've got to think surely things are going to move forwards because there's fewer loopholes within the entire process.
I think so. But and also their sort of anti-greenwashing legislation, which has had an impact because so many of these brands are global brands and France is a part of where they sell to. It's a large part of where they sell to. So they're kind of having to change for every country because of the French government, which is good, I think.
Yeah, it's really good. Jane, thank you so much. It's been real pleasure talking to you and getting to meet one of my career idols. So thank you so much for taking the time speaking to us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it.
Next week, WGSN's Create Tomorrow podcast is back with another episode examining the future of product and design. Hit the follow or subscribe button and be the first to know when we release our next podcast. I'm Carla Bazzacchi, CEO of WGSN. I'll see you next time.